I forget from week to week. Okay. The price of spoke. Let's get going. Yeah, the Mishnah in Kiddushin and the Chav Tes lists mitzvahs ha'ava laben. There are certain mitzvahs that a father has to do for his son. For example, a father has to do, make sure and ensure that his son gets a bris milah. A father has to make sure that his son learns Torah. A father has to make sure that his son, if he's a bechor, has a pinyan abet, he has to teach him a trade. There are certain things that a father has to do for his son. And the Mishnah lists it over there. Mitzvah sa'av al aben and kiddushin chavtes. But according to Rabbi Meir, he has to teach him to swim. But the question is raised, why is it that the mitzvah of telling him the Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim is not listed over there? Another thing that a father has to do for his son is to tell him Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. Right? It says, Ve'igata levincha, you're supposed to tell your son. So why is that not in the list in the Mishnah of Kiddushin of things that the father has to do for the son? Some people want to suggest, very simply, that the reason why it's not in the list of things that a father has to do for the son is, in fact, it is on the list. One of the things on the list is Talmud Torah. And telling over the Haggadah is a form of Talmud Torah. Right? You're telling the story that is written in Chumash and Sefer Shmos, through Psukim that are written in Sefer Devarim. You're darshaning the Psukim. It's a form of Talmud Torah, so it is listed. That's what some people want to say. But there's others that want to suggest otherwise. And the truth is, I want to say the following. The Mishnah lists mitzvahs that a father has to do for a son. However, the mitzvah of Igata Levincha, say a lot of them, Parshim, is not a mitzvah that you have to do for your son. Is it a mitzvah that you have to do for yourself? Right? To tell over the story of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim is something that you do for yourself. The pasuk over here says, in the Perek Yud, pasuk Beis, so it says, Lema'an tesaper be'oznei bincha uven bincha. You will tell your son and your grandson, your children, et asher italalti b'mitzrayim ve'et atotai asher samti bam, that which I did to Mitzrayim, the miraculous events that occur there, v'idatem ki ani Hashem, and you should know that I am Hashem. The notion is that we tell it over not necessarily for our children. We tell it over for ourselves. Oftentimes when we, and this is a big concept, we spoke about it at night in our Musaf of Rusa also, in the Nesivah Shalom, the more you speak about certain events and the more they become part and parcel of your daily existence, the more important it becomes to you and the more entrenched you become in the Muna. It's not necessarily something you do for your son. Right, we thought about it different. We thought that, let's say you have a son that for whatever reason came home late from shul on the Seder night. You are waiting at the table, he doesn't show up, alright, whatever, I'll start. You start, and then at 3 o'clock in the morning your son shows up and he says, alright, tell me the story. So up until now you thought, alright, I have to tell him the story, I'm required to because, you know, he's my son. The answer is no, you could tell, you don't have to tell him the story. If you've told it to yourself already, the mitzvah is really for you, it's not for your son. The more you speak about that emunah, the more it becomes entrenched in you. It is a mitzvah for you. Okay, interesting idea. It's from the Toldos Adam Ostrava. Okay, we have an interesting, board number two, we have an interesting episode in this week's Parsha. HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Moshe, listen, you gotta do me a favor, the Jewish people have to do me a favor. What is that favor? In Perek Yud Aleph, Pasuk Beis, Hashem says, "Daber nabo uzneiam, please speak to the people. Ve'yishalu ish me'edre eyu, ve'yisha me'edre uta. I want all the men, all the women. I want them to please take from the Egyptians klei chesef uklei zahav. I want them to take gold and silver. So what's this all about? So Rashi points out, God is asking, "Daber na, please tell the Jewish people to do this. Why?" He says, I told Abraham that after his children will be enslaved, they're going to leave that bondage. And not only will they leave, but they're going to leave with truckloads of money, gold and silver. He says, please make sure that they ask for that gold and silver from the Egyptians. Otherwise, I'm going to look like a liar to Abraham Avinu. People ask the question, why is it that it had to come about in such a manner? Why did it have to be that HaKadosh Baruch Hu told the Jewish people to borrow or to take rather from the Egyptians gold and silver. Why couldn't he just produce gold and silver? He produced man, he produced the well for the water, he produced many things. So why can't he just conjure up gold and silver? I doubt that it was a fear of inflating the market and flooding it with too much gold and silver, making it less special. Why was it necessary to do it in such a way? So the Jews of the Mordechai Kamenetsky tries to answer this question with a story about the Rashash. The Rashash, Shmuel Strauss, and he's in the back of your Gemara. What's amazing about the Rashash was that he was not he was a rabbi, but that was not his profession. His profession was to be a banker, but he was but his passion was Torah, and he wrote, it's an amazing thing, if you look at the back of your Shas, and all but four dapim in all of Shas, the Rashash has a commentary on. Four daf. Out of the thousands of daf in Shas, he wrote on all but four. And he was not a full-time learner. He was a banker. The reason why, in fact, we have him in the back of the Gemara is because he was so wealthy that he was able to finance a printing of the Shas. And he put his own Kiddushim in the back. And they were so good that all generations now, when they copy over a Shas, they copy it with the Rashash. But the Rashash was a very, very wealthy individual. A paradigm of Hasmada, as we just said. He wrote on every single daf of Shas. And also, he was a Baal Chesed. He would help people. And one time it happened that a person came to him for a loan. A poor person came to him for a loan. And the Rashash, without batting an eyelid, said, "No problem, here's the loan." Gave him the money, however many ruble it was. And he said, "Okay, 30 days from now, please pay back the loan." And sure enough, 30 days later, the person came to pay back the loan. The Rashash was engaged in his learning. So he gave the Rashash the money, but the Rashash was so caught up in his learning, he just absent-mindedly took the money, put it in the back of his sefer, you know, like we would sometimes do with a piece of paper, and continued to learn on the daf that he was on. At the end of the learning session, he just closed the book, totally forgot that the poor person had given him back the money. 30 days later, he looks at his ledger, and he sees the person never paid back the money. He never marked down that he paid back. So he went to the person and he said, "You owe me the money." The poor person said, "I paid you back." "No, it's not in my ledger. I'm pretty sure that had you paid me back, I would write it in the ledger." He says, "I paid you back." So what's the din when the person comes and he says, "You owe me $100 and the other person says, "I paid you back," or he just denies the loan? He has to take what? He has to take a shvua. He has to swear, "I swear that I paid you back." And then that's it. He doesn't have to pay back, all he says, "Swear I paid you back." So he says, "Okay, listen, I paid you back." The Rashash says, "Well, the din is you have to take a shvua." He says, "I'll take the shvua." The Rashash, however, said, "No, I don't want you to take the shvua." Right? The Rashash felt like shvua is a serious thing, and he was pretty convinced. He didn't want that this guy should maybe, on the off chance, maybe be nishbal sheker. He's like, "Forget it, don't take the shvua. Forget it, you don't have to pay me back, it's fine, forget it." But what happened? Everyone in the town in the meantime heard about this episode, and what did they assume? They assumed that, of course, the guy never paid back, and the Rashash is a tzaddik who just says, "You don't have to pay me back, you don't have to pay me back, you don't have to worry about it." And for a long time, everyone began to turn their back on this poor person. They're like, "Oh, you're the guy that stiffed the Rashash on his cash, you're that guy," and they turned their back on him. A few months later, the Rashash was learning through the sefer again, and from the back of the sefer, as he opened it up, fell out the money. And the Rashash looked at the money and says, "Like, wow, he paid me back. It's absolutely true. It all came back to him. He paid me back." So he goes to the person and says, "I'm so sorry you paid me back. I am so, so sorry. I'm happy you're sorry. I appreciate your apology, but I'm ruined anyway. Even if you now go and tell everyone, yeah, he paid me back, nobody's going to be, they're just going to say, the Rashash is a tzaddik, and the Rashash is a tzaddik, and so he's saying he paid me back." He says, "There's nothing we can do over here." And the Rashash says, it's hard for us to fathom in today's day and age of dating and going out for 2 or 3 years. The Rashash says, "I have an idea." He says, "I have a daughter and you have a son. I have a son, you have a daughter." He says, "Let's make a shidduch between the two of them. Then everyone will know that it is true, that really I had the money, because I would not make a shidduch with somebody who said, they would know." And that's what they did. They did that extreme act. The Rashash's son married the poor man's daughter, and thus everyone knew that he really had in fact paid him back. The Rashash clearly would not marry. Sometimes you need extreme measures. So how does all this relate back to our question of why is it that they had to borrow from the Egyptians? What was he concerned about Abraham? That they had to take money from the Egyptians. So the problem was that to just give him money wouldn't have sufficed. After 400 years of, well, depending on how you do the cheshbon, after 210 years of slavery and backbreaking labor, there was a slave mentality that was attached to the Jewish people. They were engrossed in a feeling of inferiority. They were engrossed in a feeling of, I am worthless. They were engrossed in the feeling of despair. To simply just one day give him, you know, a truckload of money wouldn't change any of that. Right? This is not, but when those people that formerly enslaved them were now showering them with gifts and saying, here, this is yours, I want you to have it, that does a lot to elevate their state of mind and get that slave mentality out of their head. And that is why it was so critical and crucial to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that it be done through this method, that it be the Jewish people take from the Egyptians the money and not that he just made gold appear just like that. Okay. Let's see what else we've got. In Perek Beis, no, Perek Yud, Pasuk Chaf Hei. No, Pasuk Chaf Dalet and Chaf Hei. So Parah says, listen, go serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's fine. I'm into it now. The only thing I ask is that you leave behind your cattle. Leave that here. Take everything else. And Moshe answers back to him, listen, buddy, not only are we going to take our cattle with us, Vayomer Moshe Pasuk Chafei, Gam Ata Titen Beyadenu Zvachim Ve'olot. You too are going to give to us Zvachim and Olos. Okay. Question is though, why is it that Moshe was insisting that not only are we going to take, but you too are going to give us Zvachim ve'olos? The Orach Chaim really accentuates it. It says, Ech Shaol Yishal Eved Hashem Zivche Elohim Meish Bazui Vetameh. Why would we want, asks the Orach Chaim, from Paro, a person who is representative of the anti-God? He is Lo Yadati Et Hashem. He has no recognition of God. He was fighting against God. He is Bazui Tameh. So why is it that he wants his sacrifices? Right. So the Shem Yishmuel in Tafresh Ayin Ches, what's that? 94 years ago. He said the following. Shem Yishmuel suggested the following. He says that, as we know, that when a fetus is in his mother's womb, then whatever the mother undergoes in some measure translates to the fetus as well. You know, whatever she eats is transferred to the baby. Whatever mood she's in is transferred to the baby. Everything is a reflection of the mother and the fetus. It says, the Jewish nation in Egypt was, in fact, a nation that was in gestation. They were born when they left Egypt. While they were in Egypt, it was a gestation period. In fact, that was their womb. Which is somewhat of an awesome thing to contemplate in general, why it had to be in Egypt and why not in a different place. But that is the fact. Given that that's the fact, says the Shem Yishmuel, it meant that anything that the Egyptians were thinking and experiencing in some way or other would impact on the Jewish people as well. And so therefore, if there was an element of resistance still left by the Egyptians, then that would have some sort of effect on the Jewish people as well. If Paro would be unwilling to give, to sacrifice to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, if he would, it's not that Moshe was interested in the sacrifice. He didn't want him to sacrifice. He just wanted him to acknowledge, and it was important that he acknowledge, he too would be willing to give it to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the sacrifice to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because ultimately, it would have an effect on the Jewish people. The environment that you're in affects the type of person that you are. That is basically what the Shem Yishmuel is saying. You might think that you can be oblivious to the environment. You might think you can be bigger than the environment. But the truth is that in some way, shape, form, or other, the environment that you put yourself in is going to affect you. Right? So, we'll hold off on hammering that nail to a different time. But that's the word of the Shemesh Mol. And that's why it was so significant that Paro too, who was the king of the environment, be giving the Zvachim Ve'olos to show that he saw the recognition of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so that it can allow all the Jews to have a recognition of HaKadosh Baruch Hu as well. Okay. While we're on the topic of Paro and what he thought was a good game plan for the Jewish people and how to worship God, so at a different step along the way, so he says to him, Paro says in Perek Yud, Pasuk Yud, listen, you go, just etapchem, don't take the children. Lechuna hagvarim, go the adults and leave the children. And what does Moshe answer back? Right, Moshe answers back, that is ridiculous. We're taking everyone. Right? We're going to take everyone. What was Paro's argument over here? Why did he not want the children to go? Paro recognized a very, very simple truth. Paro recognized that the future of the Jewish people rests with the children. Right? It is not enough to simply take care of the adults. It is as important, if not more important, if you want to have continuity, to ensure that you take care of the children as well. That is the responsibility of the adult generation towards their children. Paro was saying, no, leave the children, don't worry about it. Serve God, you know. It doesn't have to be for the children as well. But they knew that if it's not for the children, if you shut the door on the children and you say, okay, I'm going to shul now, you stay here, and then, you know. It doesn't work that way. A kid needs to be taken to shul as well. He needs to experience the shul. You need to take him. It doesn't work if you just say, yeah, Abba is going to go learn, and then you stay here. You know, we'll meet later. The kid has to be part and parcel of that Jewish life as well. It's the responsibility of parents. It's the responsibility of adults. Frankly, everyone here is an adult. You know, during the summer, you guys are still young. You can invest a few years in going to camp and being counselor for younger children. It's not, if you have a sense of responsibility to your religion, then it's not enough to just be self-absorbed and do whatever is just good for you. You also have to do what's good for the children and for the next generations. If you can't do camp, then during the year you can do youth groups. If you can't do youth groups, then a Shabbaton once a month or whatever it may be. It's important to recognize that the Jewish religion rests also in the future generations, and we have a responsibility to that as well. Paro was very clever. He said, leave the children behind, but we know that if you leave the children behind, there's nothing left. You must take it with you. You must open the doors to them as well. Okay. This is an exciting parsha, because Rashi in Sefer Bereshit, at the very opening of Sefer Bereshit, says that really the Torah should have started in Parshas Bo. The Torah should have started from the first mitzvah that was given the Jewish people, which is HaChodesh HaZeh Lachem, Perek Yud Beis Pasuk Aleph. This is where the Torah should have started. Right? Obviously, for different considerations, we did in fact start in Sefer Bereshit and all of that. Listen, but for all intents and purposes, on a certain level, Rashi feels like this is the place where the Torah should have started, right here, with the first mitzvah given to the Jewish people. Which just raises the point, why is this the first mitzvah? What is so significant about this mitzvah? What is so unique about this mitzvah? What is so important about this mitzvah? Why was this the first mitzvah given to the Jewish people? So, a few answers given. Let's focus on one, on two of them. The Nesiv HaShalom says the following, HaChodesh HaZeh Lachem. Quotes from Rashi, right? Moshe was having a difficult time figuring out how to do Rosh Chodesh, how to figure out Rosh Chodesh. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu showed him, when you see the crest like this, crescent just like that, that's how you know it's Rosh Chodesh. Right? The mitzvah of Kiddush HaChodesh, says in the Nesiv HaShalom, is a very, very powerful lesson for us as the Jewish people. How so? When is it that Rosh Chodesh begins? Right? Rosh Chodesh begins at when the moon is full? No. It begins when it is at its darkest. Right? You can hardly see the moon. That is Rosh Chodesh. And that is right, and that is the lesson for the Jewish people as they are right now in Egypt and have just experienced tremendous amount of darkness, and throughout the history, throughout the ages, they've experienced a tremendous amount of darkness, right? Egypt, right, to the Gullus again, to Crusades, pogroms, libels, Holocaust. It's just constant darkness. And the lesson of Achodesh Zalachem is that even though in the time of darkness it is dark, but there's always a rejuvenation, no pun intended. There's always a light that regenerates itself. And that's an important lesson to keep on going. We say in the Pasuk in Tehillim, Lahagid baboker chastecha ve'emunascha balelos. Right? During the day, Lahagid baboka chastecha, it's clear to see the chesed of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. At night, balelos, it is sometimes hard. But there has to be a sense of emunascha balelos. There has to be a sense of belief during the night that things will become better, things will improve. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is there watching us. It is not like it is not helter-skelter. It is not that we're left to our own vices and good luck. Even throughout the darkness, we have to believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is there watching us. The pasuk in Malachi says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu takes the form of a smith with silver. Right? The same way a silversmith works the silver, so too HaKadosh Baruch Hu works the Jewish people. So Rabbi Krohn tells the story of a woman's Tanakh group who was learning this pasuk, and they were trying to figure out why is it that the Navi and Malachi used the imagery of a silversmith. What's so unique about that? So one of the women decided that she would go to a silversmith and she would observe and see what's going on. So she went to the silversmith and she saw that the silversmith was putting the silver, the raw silver, into the fire. She says to him, "How come you're putting the raw silver into the fire?" So he says, "Well, you know, you have to put it into the fire because that's how you burn off the impurities." So she says, "Huh." So she begins, "I guess, you know, sometimes the Jewish people have to go through that darkness too, because we have to burn off a certain amount of impurities, a sense of refinement, the refined silver." She says, "Okay." She says, "Well, tell me though, you know, I noticed that you're just sitting here. How come you're saying so? Well, I have to watch it. If I don't watch it, then it could be that it will burn more than just the impurities. It will even burn the part of the precious silver that I need. So therefore, I sit here the entire time watching it." She says, "So maybe perhaps that's why Kadosh Baruch Hu is just like a silversmith. It's not just that he's burning off impurities, but he's there the whole time watching us. We might not sense it. We might think this is so, but he's there watching the whole time." And then the kicker, she says, "By the way," as she's observing, "how do you know when it's just, when you've burned off the impurities and when it's just pure silver?" He says, "That's easy. When I can see my reflection in the silver, that's how I know it's ready." She said, "When the Jew," same thing on Kodesh Baruch Hu, "when the Kodesh Baruch Hu can see us reflected in his, when we can reflect the Kodesh Baruch Hu in our actions, that's how he knows the impurities are burnt off." But that is the notion of Achodesh Zalachem. There is darkness, but that darkness is guaranteed to be light again. It's cyclical. It goes back to light, and we just have to be aware that throughout the darkness, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is there watching as well, looking for our reflection the same way the moon reflects the sun of the light. The light of the sun. Okay. Another explanation of Achodesh Zalachem. Why is this the first mitzvah? So the Sforno over here says, "Mikan ve'elach yiyu achadashim shalachem." From here on in, right, the chodesh, a chodesh hazeh is lachem, is yours. While you were enslaved, while you were answering to other people, why is this the first one? While you were answering to other people and you did not have freedom, you did not control time, right? You did not, you were not really your own people. You were not free to do, essentially, you were not yet born. Once you are given free time, now you are born, now you are free, now you are free to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. This is, by the way, those of you that have read the book, Rabbi Lau's book, it was translated into English. I think in English it's called Out of the Depths, something like that. The story of his experience through Buchenwald and the entire, you know, his rise to the chief rabbi and through. So he describes in it that his birthday is in fact Chaf Ches Nisan, which is not his real birthday, but that's the day that he celebrates as his birthday. And he explains that that's the day that Buchenwald was liberated. The minute he became free from Buchenwald and he did not answer to other people, that is the day that he was born. Until that time, he felt like he was not... life wasn't his. He wasn't living his life. He was living the Nazis, Yimach Shemam's life. He was at their whim. He was at their control. Whatever they said, he had to do. Whatever they desired, he had to oblige. And he was not... Once the liberation came, that is when he was... And the same thing with the Achodesh Azalachem, right, is that the first mitzvah is you have to control time. Right? Control time, to be in charge of your own time, that is what... that is the greatest and most important element of your life. Right? It's a simple equation. Right? Right? You have free time. You have freedom, gives you time, which gives you life. It's a simple equation. But ultimately, unfortunately, sometimes we tend to forget that equation. As simple as it is, freedom gives you time, which gives you life. We tend to forget how important time is, right? Which is weird. When somebody tragically passes away, so we're beside ourselves. Oh, what a tragedy. But when somebody just wastes an hour of time, for whatever reason, we don't react. And we should. That's essentially what it's tragic. Right? Time is life, and we're not taking care of it. So we speak about sometimes about killing time. Killing time is killing ourselves. It's a very, very... we're very complacent about it. Right? The loss of life is tragic, but we're complacent about the loss of time. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter says that he was always very jealous. In Vilna, there was a shoemaker. And the shoemaker would be stitching the shoes to the light of the candle. And you would see, even as he was flickering, the shoemaker would get close to the shoe just to be able to capitalize on that last second or two of candlelight so that he can get that last stitch in. He says, wow, I wish I was as... he says, what a lesson. To utilize every last second of your life. He didn't. Right? That's what we have. That's a Chodesh Azalachem. We preach it and we say, yeah, it's so important to have time. And we view it as so tragic when somebody Chas V'Shalom. And yet, in our lives often, we are complacent about, I just want to have some free time. Free time. Just want to kill some time. I have an hour to kill. Right. It's not good. Chodesh Azalachem, the first mitzvah, because if you want to be truly free, you have to learn how to control time and how to take advantage of your time. Okay. Well, unfortunately, we have a few more, but we'll stop here. We'll continue Blina there next week with Parshas Vishal.